This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So it's my pleasure, as always, to introduce Dr. Chris Owens, one of the co-chairs of this program, to talk to us a bit about patient-level risk factors in CLI.
Thank you, Warren. I think during this session, we're going to try to break it down from you from the sort of the global from the patient level factors to the limb and then finally down to the foot. So we'll take a 10,000 foot view and we'll go down to a 100 foot view and then we'll go down right down into the 1 foot view. I was just talking to some folks at the during the break and. The top five papers that are most cited in vascular surgery was published in a paper that that came out of the 50 most influential papers in vascular surgery. All five of the top five were papers on carotids and how we deal with carotid disease, asymptomatic and symptomatic, and how we choose which ones to operate. So just as a little tidbit there. So I'm going to get on with the task at hand. I'm on charge to tell you or convince you that it's not critical limb ischemia, it should be called critical patient ischemia, and I'll try to show you why. I'm a paid to talk about peripheral interventions by Bard and Medtronic as my disclosures. So the natural history of the critical limb ischemia patient is a model of competing risks. Which is going to happen first? Are they going to die, or is the limb going to be amputated? These are the major adverse outcomes that can affect this population. They're pretty much equal in terms of mortality and amputation here at 1 year for the untreated CLI patients. Now, this is a rather old study, but I like it because it kind of emphasizes what I wanted to point out to you is that really we have to be very careful for both of these things, and they have equally opportunities of happening. I practice in a veterans hospital situation, and I like to look at veteran data. So this is a survival of 4,061 vets undergoing either a femtopopliteal bypass or a femtibial bypass, and what happened to them. Now, this is a rather old data set because it was published in 2001. That means the data was collected in the 90s, which is probably before widespread adoption of statins. Nevertheless, it gives you some idea of what happens to 4,000 patients, and we don't have a lot of studies at 4,000 patients. One thing I wanted to point out, of these 4,000 patients, we have 3,642 of them produce 17,694 readmissions. That's astounding. That's an astounding number. 1,559 were admitted five times. Now, Dr. Gasper, have you seen this? Dr. Gasper is a VA patient. He understands this happens, and I'm sure it happens in your practice too. This is extremely expensive. 1,097 additional bypass grafting procedures. So clearly, bypass surgery, even before statins, quite onerous on these patients in this patient population. Quite a lot of healthcare risk. Major amputation after femoral popliteal bypass. Why that's higher than the anterior tibial bypass, it's unclear, but I got some ideas that we'll go into a little bit later. What about functional status after lower extremity revascularization of nursing home residents? If you're not functional prior to the surgery and you're admitted into a nursing home, you probably don't have a whole good chance of long time life expectancy. Here we see that the non-ambulatory patients that had procedures done, lower extremity revascularization, regardless of what the revascularization was, 50% were dead in 1 year. So how do we work with this? You know, we have competing risk of death and amputation. We have a very comorbid population. There are risk scores. This is the second time this risk score has been presented this session or this morning. This is a CLI risk score, developed off the PREVENT 3 database of 1,400 patients and then validated again in the vascular surgery group in New England. It's one of the 25 or so papers out of the vascular surgery group in New England. And look at the risk score. It's dialysis, it's tissue loss, it's age greater than 75, it's hematocrit greater than less than 30, and it's coronary artery disease. Well, this is fine, and this is good for stratification, but they're really not really modifiable. You can't do much about the age or if they're on dialysis. I mean, you get what you get, and they can help stratify your risk in terms of what you should do, or maybe, but you really can't do anything more. In addition, I'd submit to you that it's pretty intuitive. You don't really need a risk score to tell you that the dialysis patient that you're doing a bypass on or a tibial angioplasty probably is going to do worse than one without renal dysfunction. So the risk prediction scores in patients with CLI, I don't think are helpful clinically. I don't think they're used a whole lot by any of us clinically, but I think they confirm what we already know. I think they have modest discriminatory ability. I don't think they're generalizable because they were developed and validated in a subset of patients that were already pre-selected to undergo intervention. What is the full denominator? We really don't know that information. And they're developed on patients that were selected for surgery already. We need an all-comer trial that's probably based at the level of the primary care physician or entry into the healthcare system to figure out what we're really doing and where it's going. We're really dealing with a subset of patients that are already coming through with a lot of pre-biases. So this is a question, an audience response question. It's regarding the biochemistry. So I'm going to take away from what I just told you and move on to a little bit different area that I think may have an opportunity to build upon that. So regarding the biochemistry of the CLI patient, which is false? And so I have two sort of opposite questions, choice B and choice D are opposite. So for test-taking strategy, I would choose one of those. And the surgeons in the audience will probably know this because it's very intuitive. We've been dealing with this kind of thing for a long time. And so what do we got here? We got choice C, have low total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and HDL cholesterol. We have choice D, albumin is the strongest risk predictor, and choice B, CRP is the strongest risk predictor. So which is false? Well, to be honest with you, low total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, and HDL cholesterol is very common in a CLI patient. And I'll show you coming up here. It'll be interesting to you. Let's talk about cachexia for a second. What is cachexia? We've heard about it. We know in cancer patients, it's a wasting disease. CHF patients, rheumatoid cachexia. It's based on a cytokinemia and the effect that cytokines have on the entire body, on multiple organs, on the neuroendocrine system, on the vascular system, basically your entire metabolism. It's a wasting disease. You do waste protein. And I would submit to you again that the cytokinemia that is associated with CLI is the same or worse than the cytokinemia associated with these diseases that are already under cachexia. What I'm saying is there's a sort of a cachexia of CLI. Looking here just at two specific cytokines, and I'm not going to talk too much about cytokines, but IL-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha receptor 2. These are very commonly measured research studies or research biomarkers. And if you look at, this is from our data, it's not published, but if you look at interleukin-6, it's higher than the patients who have CHF stage 4 heart failure. And if you look at TNF-alpha receptor 2, which is a very common marker for the CHF heart failure stratification, it's higher in PAD with CLI. So that PAD means CLI here. So the cachexia that I would presume comes from these cytokines of a CLI patient, of the six CLI patients that you've taken care of, is probably very similar to what you might get in an end-stage heart failure patient or a rheumatoid factor patient. Now, you could say, well, Chris, these are just wounds that are leaking these things. I want to make sure that we selected these patients so that they did not have infections of the foot. We would allow small non-infected ulcers, but and as demonstrated here, the white blood cell count is actually between the CLI patients and the claudication patients. There's no difference. But CLI has lower albumin. Albumin is the strongest risk predictor of anything we measure. If you look at albumin and this was proven in the VA in the 1990s, I think Joe Rapp would know, 80s. this is the strongest risk predictor that we have. CRP is a good one, but it's not as strong as albumin. That was the correct answer. EGFR is lower, but it's not that much lower than claudication patients. And again, hemoglobin is a little bit lower too. What about cholesterol? What about total cholesterol? Well, CLI patients have lower total cholesterol. They have very low LDLs and HDLs. Why is that? Well, these cholesterol, these lipoproteins are carried by apolipoproteins, which are the proteins that basically carry the rafts that carry them through the bloodstream. This could be due to statins, but I'd also submit to you that it's not. When we look at statins, the patients who are not on statins weren't on statins probably because they didn't have high cholesterol in the first place. This was this data was collected in the mid-2000s, but since the adoption of statins. You can see by the standard deviations that these groups are pretty similar, but still, again, there's more there's less cholesterol, LDL and HDL in the critical limb ischemia patient, probably because of the high cytokines and the decreased production of apolipoproteins and albumin, et cetera. When you look at the inflammation sort of whole profile and you look at and you stage by these biomarkers, inflammatory cytokines, they're higher in CLI than in claudication. They're very high, in fact. CRP, MCP1, and the tumor necrosis factor receptor that we just talked about. And if you look at them in terms of survival, these are all univariate analysis. Patients with lower cholesterol do worse in CLI. Patients with lower albumin do worse in CLI. Higher inflammation, they do worse. It's paradoxical in a way. Cholesterol has a J-shaped mortality curve. If you want to look at prediction, C-statistic. The C-statistic basically tells us if I have two patients, how likely, one with a disease, one without a disease, how likely am I to know which one it is? And the statistic here for the clinical model would be I'm 70% likely, 0.7072. Don't worry about this. We're not going to talk about it. But I have a 70% chance of differentiating whether dead or alive at 1 year if I just use a clinical risk factor model of age, diabetes, coronary disease, and whether they have critical limb ischemia or not. But if I start adding in a glomerular filtration rate, albumin, I can get that up to 82%. We're not going to talk about IDI either. If we just look at prediction in another graphical way, if you're more a visual learner, you can see the ROC, which is a very the area under the ROC curve, these receiver operating characteristic curves. It's very similar to the C statistic. And this is just with age, diabetes, CAD, and CLI. You can't modify any of these things. You potentially could modify the level of inflammation or protein. And again, we're getting up into the 80s when we add these other biochemical factors. Another way of looking at it is, remember, the renal function is not that impaired, less than 60. These are a dime a dozen, EGFR of 55 or 56. Albumin, I'm not talking about malnutrition to the level of less than 3.0, just less than 3.5, or inflammation greater than 5 milligrams per liter. If you are in the unlucky person to be in this convergence of these circles here, there's 21 patients, you're nearly 10 times as likely to die following a procedure within a year. So I want to talk about one potential way of mitigating some of this stuff, and this is some work that we've been doing, whereby we're trying anti-inflammatory medication at the level of the blood vessel when we're treating it. We know that angioplasty causes an inflammatory response. We think that if we can knock down the inflammatory spots, we'll subsequently decrease entomoproplasia and restenosis. This is the outside of the blood vessel. This is the inside of the blood vessel. This is all the stuff that happens after balloon angioplasty. We use a catheter that from Mercator Med Systems. It's a microinfusion catheter. It has two ports, one for the balloon that causes a backwards pressure that pushes the needle up to the blood vessel, and then, of course, one port that actually injects dilute contrast of whatever drug you want to try and contrast so that you can see it visually on fluoroscopy. And this is what it looks like when you show fluoroscopy. This is not an angiogram over here on the right side. This is actually just the dexamethasone with the adventitial infusion across the whole blood vessel. And then, of course, this is the angiogram right here. These are the trials that are running right now. The DANCE trial, we just got notice that we have 204 patients enrolled, so just a year. So it's enrolling very fast, which I think is some testimony to the buy-in of the PIs that we have. A third of them are going to get biomarkers data, and I can show you just a little bit of biomarker data today, which I think is pretty cool. There's also a registry, and particularly for this talk, there's this trial called LIMBO that's going to be coming out soon. It's going to be run both in Leipzig and also in the United States, two arms, a PTA arm and a atherectomy arm. And so this is going to begin about Q2 2015. It's going to be 120 patients with PTA and 120 patients with AI with atherectomy. Now, this is a little bit of a peek at our interim data. This is a Schillinger paper that was published in the a few years ago, which basically showed the peri-inflammatory response to an intervention is related to subsequent restenosis down the road. And if you have a pretty high increase in your inflammatory response, you have higher chance of having a restenosis. Whereas in patients who had a lower increase after the intervention, they had a lower chance of intervention. We did a tiny little pilot study at the VA, and we showed that, you know, we put some dexamethasone in the blood vessel. It was a very heterogeneous group of patients. It was pure safety and feasibility, but we thought we had a decent little signal here. So we went ahead, and in 18 patients with PTA and 27 patients with atherectomy, we have actually some data showing that the post-inflammatory response is not that high. I don't know what it means. It's a surrogate marker, but at least it says that we're maybe doing what we intend to do with the dexamethasone. It's interesting that the atherectomy appears to cause less injury than the balloon angioplasty. It's totally opposite of what I would have thought. It's not what my hypothesis would have been. You heard me yesterday talk about atherectomy. But here we go. This is real-world data. It's not that much. So let me give you a conceptual framework of what you can do for inflammation, perhaps in your own practice. Well, we're informed by, you know, some of the larger trials. You know, that green on the left side is sort of the Paul Ricker area. That's your Jupiter trial, which is compared to rosuvastatin in patients who otherwise would not have received a statin. Your CRIT study, which is a canakinumab, which is a monoclonal antibody to interleukin-1 beta, methotrexate. It's a very low dose Q-week methotrexate, omega fatty acids. This is Marlene's square right here. She's doing the high dose omegas. Could try pulse steroids. Some evidence suggests pulse steroids. Very high dose vitamin D. Check the vitamin D levels in your patients. They're all low. I don't know what that means, whether it's a co-founder or whether it's actually causative. I'm working sort of in this space, and Dr. Conti's actually working on some very interesting resolvins and lipoxins that hopefully we'll be able to tell you about next year. And then there's all kinds of things that are coming up we've talked about today with the drug or this session with the drug-coated stents and balloons and things like that. So in conclusion, patients with CLI have two primary competing risks. It's death and amputation that you got to guard against. Critical limb ischemia patients should be critical patient ischemia. A subset of have actually a vascular cachexia characterized by these high cytokines. Current risk models have had little benefit over intuition, but may be important in comparative risk evaluations, creating observed over expected risk, research, et cetera. Current risk models are not modifiable. Biochemical model may be more accurate. For example, I showed you an example with a C statistic of 0.82, and biochemical models may be modifiable. I want to thank you for your attention for the whole course. Make sure you fill out your evaluations. We need to see those. Anything I said that's true, I attribute to Mike Conti and Joe Rapp and Linda and these guys over here. Anything I said is probably not true is probably my own mistake. I have a whole new respect and appreciation for this man right here, having done my inaugural one here. Warren Gasper, I couldn't have, you know, he helps me in my clinic. I couldn't have done this without him and Marlene and Sandy and everybody else. So thank you very much for all your attention. Happy to entertain any questions.
All right. Well, Chris, that was great. But just so one question in terms of that new biochemical risk model that you have, what do you do with the patient that's in the eye of that hurricane, the low albumin, poor GFR, high CRP patient?
Well, I think Mike showed us some pretty compelling data that sometimes you don't have to do anything. If they don't have infection, they don't have some kind of compelling reason, maybe just sit it out a little bit and wait. And there's pretty good limb salvage just doing that. I suspect those patients would be pretty disabled. I wouldn't do a bypass on them, though. Those are the patients who are going to have wound breakdown and a bunch of other problems.
Great. Well, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.